Our last speaker, as Giles said, is a terrific contestant on Just a Minute. He's quite a remarkable polymath. He first came to attention with his great friend Hugh Laurie in A Bit of Fry and Laurie in Jeeves and Worcester. He was a brilliant General Melchett in Blackadder. He's presented 180 episodes of QI. He's narrated all seven Harry Potter novels, as Sam was referring to. He's written four novels, three volumes of autobiography, and amazingly, he's now pulled off, brilliant word, a tetralogy about classics. First in Mythos, then with Heroes, then with Troy, and now his remarkable book, Odyssey. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Fry.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Harry. That's incredibly kind of you. A lovely introduction. You didn't mention my modesty, which rather annoyed me. I was thinking about what I would say to you all. It's a very exciting thing to be able to address an oldies luncheon. And I don't want to let you or myself down, but I thought I would really just tell a lot of stories in the end, because stories are really where it all begins for me. We often talk about talent, ability, opportunity, so on. But it's very rarely that we talk about what people are terrible at. And the reason I am here is because I am so terrible at so many things that really most people value. And I discovered this when I went to school. I was sent away at the age of seven to a prep school. And I arrived like a little hopeful puppy, hoping to make friends, hoping to make something of myself and to be liked in the way that children do. And I very quickly discovered that I was going to have the life of a worm, of a completely ignored and hated and unpopular little tick, because I couldn't do anything that was of value. Sport was the first thing I couldn't do and is the first thing that most boys value. I couldn't catch a ball. I was the kind of slightly uncoordinated figure that would, when the ball came towards me, clap my hands together instead of, you know, falling back. And I couldn't run in a straight line without colliding with a tree. I would trip over the white lines on a tennis court, to be honest. So I discovered that I couldn't do sport. So that was one thing that made me a worm. But also I couldn't dance or sing. I didn't know why I couldn't sing until years later. It was the most extraordinary discovery that I made. I was writing a sketch with my friend Hugh Laurie, whom Harry mentioned, for a series called Friday Live on Channel 4, and it was, as the name implies, live. And we'd written this sketch on a Wednesday, and on Thursday morning I said to Hugh, hang on, I can't do this sketch with you. It involves me singing. He says, oh, well, you can sing. I said, no, I can't sing. He said, no, you can sing. I said, I really cannot sing. You know I can't sing. You've never heard me sing. He said, well, that's true. I've never heard you sing. Can you really not sing? And I started to sing. He said, no, you can't sing. I said, we've got to swap the parts around, which we couldn't really do because the other part involved playing the guitar, which I couldn't do either. So he suggested I go and see a psychiatrist. And then he said, no, not a psychiatrist. Go and see a hypnotist. That's the answer, because I bet it's something. It's a little block in your head. So I went to see a hypnotist that very afternoon. I literally made my fingers do the walking, as they used to say. The Yellow Pages listed hypnotists in those days. And this was a Hungarian. And I went to his office, and he said, I want you to sit down and put your hands on your knees and feel the flesh of your palms merge with the flesh of your thighs until you cannot sense the difference between your hands and your legs. They are all one. It's brilliant. It works. I hope you're not doing it because you might go to sleep. He said, now I'm going to lower you down OL. I said, down a what? He said, down a well. I said, oh, well. He said, yes. He said, you will go lower and lower into this well, and I'm holding you up with a rope that is my voice. So you hear my voice. It keeps you safe, but you're in darkness. And as we go lower and lower and lower, you become more and more at peace, and quieter and more relaxed. It was really did work. It was extraordinary. I was completely under. I'd never really believed in hypnotism, but it absolutely worked. And he said, why can't you sing? When did you get the impression that you couldn't sing? And I remembered we had at prep school a thing called Cong Prac, which was short for Congregational Practice. And on Saturdays, we would be taught a hymn that the school didn't know that would be sung the next day on Sunday. And this prefect was walking up and down, and he suddenly said, stop, everyone, stop, Fry, sing what you just sang. And I sang. It was Jerusalem the Golden was the hymn, I remembered. While under the influence, I remembered. And he pointed at me and said, Fry singing flat. And the whole school laughed. And I felt like an inch high. I went completely purple, was deeply embarrassed. And from that moment, never been able to sing in public. And I'd forgotten this entirely. It came up in the hypnotism. And so the hypnotist said to me, what is the, how do you say the words that you are said to you that you must say back? I said, I don't know what you mean. He said, he says to you something, and then you sing. I said, oh, the cue. Yes, the cue. What is the cue that you should sing in this sketch you do tomorrow on the television? I said, well, it's a bit strange, but he says to me, hit it, bitch. Hit it, bitch. Yes, hit it, bitch. Hit it, bitch. Okay. When you hear the words, hit it, bitch, you will be relaxed and you will be able to sing, and your musicality, your natural music will come out of you and you will be able to sing. And now I pull up on the rope and you come up from the well. And he pulled me up and woke me up, and I thought, amazing. And on the Friday evening, it's actually on YouTube, you can see it, Hugh says to me, hit it, bitch. And I sing, and it worked. And I thought, this is fantastic. And then 2 weeks later, it was around this time of year, we were at a party and someone was around the piano with Christmas songs, and I joined in, and I was about to open my mouth, and I thought, oh, bollocks. I went into the next room and picked up a phone, called Hugh Laurie and said, Hugh, you've got to say hit it, bitch. So every time I have to sing, Hugh has to say hit it, bitch to me. I don't know how we got into that subject. So I couldn't sing, that's the point. I couldn't sing, I couldn't do sport. I couldn't paint, I couldn't draw. I couldn't really colour in, to be perfectly honest. In other words, I was all prepared for a life of complete failure, anonymity, despair. But ironically, it was a music lesson. And the teacher came in, and they were going to teach us about the parts of the orchestra. And they wrote orchestra up on the blackboard. And I immediately pointed at it and squeaked out, cart horse. He said, excuse me? I said, cart horse. He said, what do you mean? I said, it says cart horse if you rearrange the letters. And he looked at it and said, oh, yes, it does. How do you know that? I said, well, I just saw it. It came out at me. The letters moved around in my head. He said, do you do that a lot? I said, well, yeah, when you look at a word, that happens, doesn't it? Don't you do that? He said, no, I don't think most people do that. It's called an anagram, he said. I said, anagram, that's a wonderful word. Anagram, I thought about anagram. There are not many anagrams of anagram, unfortunately. But anyway, he was very interested in this, and he told other teachers, and other teachers came to me and said, do you do this? And they made me learn words, and I started to learn Latin, and then was put on ancient Greek. And suddenly, I found there was something I could do. Language. It's something that, you know, Giles just spoke about, the importance of words and language. And I was saying to Harry earlier, we all have it. You listening to me are using language as much as I am by talking to you. It is a miracle of humanity that we have this astonishing gift to be able to present ideas and to paint pictures, to beguile, to seduce, to delight, to entertain, to frighten, to do all the things that words can do. And the sensual pleasure of the tongue hitting the back of the teeth is enough to give real joy, real delight, jouissance, as Roland Barthes called it, the jouissance de la texte. It is a fantastic gift. And I realised that I had it, but I also realised everybody else had it, but nobody else seemed interested in the fact they had it. They didn't seem to celebrate it. If someone could draw or paint, everyone went, wow, look what you can do. But the fact that people could use words in the way that you are using them by listening, and that you use them when you talk to your friends and your loved ones, and you're angry and you're happy and you're joyful. It is the most miraculous gift that we have in the world. It is an astonishing thing. It is our one supreme achievement as a species that raises us above anyone else. It's the only thing that will save us, and of course it was the only thing that will doom us as well, because it can be, it has no moral valency. It can be used to write Mein Kampf or the sonnets of Shakespeare. The words themselves don't know what they're saying, if you know what I mean. But anyway, so I have since found that anagrams are a useful way of making friends. I was very lucky to know Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, or co-founder of Apple. And I remember when he came back to Apple in the 90s, we were together and he was showing me the latest PowerBooks, the laptop machines. And I said to him, these laptop machines is very interesting. He said, yeah. I said, no, the word laptop machines. He said, why? I said, it's an anagram of Apple Macintosh. He said, shut up. I said, no, it is, it is. There was a whiteboard in the room. I wrote it up. And I wrote up, you know, laptop machines, and then took the letters out to spell Apple Macintosh. It's a perfect anagram. He said, you are fucking weird. Then I remember I was lucky enough to know Alec Guinness a bit, great Alec Guinness, and we would occasionally have lunch at the Connaught, his favourite watering hole and dining place. And I was late one lunch. It wasn't my fault, but I was slightly late. And he was of a generation where, you know, being late was unacceptable, and I agreed with him. And he said, I've been doing the crossword. He said, you can complete it. And I sort of looked at it and I filled in a few. He said, oh, you're very good at anagrams. I said, well, yeah, I am. Oh, I said, I've just seen an anagram of your name. He said, I hope it's not like the one you gave Alan, because I get Alan Bates, who was a mutual friend, I called Anal Beast. And I said, no, your name is a perfect anagram of genuine class. And he said, I'm going to remember you in my will. Which, unfortunately, he didn't. Just a half percentage point in Star Wars would have been fine. But he was, you know, it is a great present, a gift you can give people, just give them anagrams. Anyway, the point is, language rescued me. Without this sudden feeling that I could use language to protect myself. For example, some of you may have children, or let's be honest, grandchildren, great-grandchildren in some cases, who are at school and might be in danger of being bullied, which is one of the worst things that can happen to any child, as I'm sure you'll all agree. Well, you are very free to use what I used at school, the Stephen Fry patent method of avoiding being bullied. The bully comes up to you, pushes you against a wall, and you simply say, no, no, don't you know, you mustn't touch me, I'll get an erection. Believe me. Oh, bloody hell. Right. Oh, God, you... Oh, dear. And off they go, baffled. I just wanted to tell a couple more stories because hearing Giles talk about Camilla and the king and everything just reminded me of the very good fortune I had of knowing a man called Martin Gilead. I don't know if any of you knew Martin Gilead. He was the Queen Mother's private secretary. Extraordinary figure. Big, 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 huge man. Great big eyebrows. Incredibly nice chap. And occasionally he was not indiscreet, but he would tell the odd story about Queen Elizabeth, as they called the Queen Mother in royal circles. The Queen was the Queen and her mother was Queen Elizabeth. And he said, oh, yes. He said, this was a long time ago, as you will be able to tell. He said, her television went on the blink, and she came to me and said, Martin, I think we need a new television. I said, well, I'll have a look, Your Majesty. And sure enough, it had that. Do you remember those old televisions that used to have a sort of horizontal roll or something they called it? Anyway, no matter how much you slapped the side of it, this one wouldn't get better. So I said, well, you've got a luncheon, ma'am. So while you're at luncheon, I'll have a nice people from Harrods come round with a new television. I said, thank you, Martin. That's invaluable. She had her luncheon. She tottered up the steps, up the stairs into the drawing room on the first floor, and I was able to show her a brand new television. She said, oh, it's very smart. And she said, I think it's larger than the last one. It is, madam. It is. It is, ma'am. It is larger. And you may notice there are no buttons for changing the channel. Oh, no, Phew, they've forgotten the buttons. No. No, it's not that. You see that little grey device there on the side table next to your gin and Dubonnet? Well, it's called a remote control. Remote control? Whatever does it do? Well, if I show you. If I press one, BBC One. Press two, BBC Two. Press three, ITV. You see? She looked at it and said, oh, that is clever. I still think it's easier to ring. Queen Elizabeth's favourite place. I should be talking about the Odyssey, but it's going to sell so well I don't need to sell it in the way that Giles does. her favourite place to stay was the Castle of Maine, up in the very north of Scotland. Castle of Maine, right at the top there. And Martin would be sort of, as it were, her husband. He'd be at the end of the table, at the head of the table, obviously King George having died many, many years earlier. And they had, as the royal family still likes to do, a very traditional dinner party where the women, you know, would leave the men to it and they'd go to the drawing room and the men would smoke their cigars and drink the port. So she stood up and said, ladies, shall we? And they went into the drawing room and she said, I tell you what, she said, let's play a trick on the men. When they come into the drawing room, let's have hidden. You hide behind that curtain. I'll go behind the fire screen. You go under the piano. We'll all hide. So when they come in, they won't know where we are. Wouldn't that be fun? So they all hide, giggling away. Martin is there, stubs out his cigar and says, well, shall we join the ladies? And out they pop, and they go into the drawing room. There's the Queen Mother trembling under the piano, and there's someone else behind the fire screen and behind the curtain. And Martin comes in with the men and says, oh, thank God for that. They've all fucked off to bed. I'll leave you with one, just another Martin story that will possibly make you go pink, but it's true and it's, I think, quite good. He said to me one day, he said, you're friends with that Rowan Atkinson, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. He said, well, why don't you invite him along to a lunch? I'll throw a lunch for the both of you. I've got a little proposition I want to make. So I said to Rowan, I said, you will love Martin Gillian, it's worth coming along. So Rowan said, okay. It was a Bucks, I think it was Bucks, it may have been Boodles, but it was a club, a London club. And yeah, it was full of old gentlemen sipping their claret and so on, in a sort of sombre, clubby mood. But Martin was always jolly, and he said to us at one point, well, now, I better explain, there is a little ulterior motive here. Do you know the Dowager Duchess of Abercorn? We both looked at each other and said we didn't have the pleasure of knowing Her Grace. I said, oh, well, she for many years was a lady-in-waiting to Queen Elizabeth, and it's her 80th birthday, and Her Majesty wants to throw a party for her at Claridge's, and so there's going to be a party, and there's a band. But Jamie Abercorn, her son, has children himself, and we felt we ought to provide something for them, and we thought some of your brand of comedy might be... a pleasant thing. Would this be something you'd be prepared to do? Maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes to half an hour of comedy at this party? And Rowan and I looked at each other and I nodded, and Rowan, who's a more cautious and sensible fellow than me, said, yes, we would be very happy to do that, but some of our material might be, I mean, the age of Her Majesty and of the Dowager Duchess. Oh, he said, don't worry about that. He said, and this at the top of his voice in the club, he said, I mean, they love the lavatory. The royal family loves the lavatory. I mean, obviously not your fucks or your cunts, he said. And Rowan went purple with embarrassment. But anyway, I'm here to celebrate the oldie, really. It is a magnificent, magnificent creation. When it first came out, I didn't do much for it. I did go to a lunch at Simpson's in the Strand, I remember. And I had the great pleasure of writing an article, a sort of My Hero article, on Alistair Sim, who is perhaps my greatest hero. And I'm always very sad when I meet young people who don't know who Alistair Sim was. So we must all spread the word of people like Alistair Sim, and indeed Rudyard Kipling, because I completely agree with Sam about the greatness of Rudyard Kipling. I was doing a podcast just this morning, funnily enough, and someone was, you know, I can't remember why the subject came around, but I was remembering that scene in Storky and Co. Do you remember the school stories he wrote, Kipling, in which he cast himself as this character called Beetle, who was the little short-sighted one, because Kipling was almost blind, really, wasn't he? And the light that failed. And there's a moment at the end, which is quite extraordinary, and it's not what people think of Kipling at all, but I think it expresses something that the average older reader would instantly relate to. And there's a politician comes and holds the flag. "My dear boys, the flag, the flag." And Storky, who in later life would turn out to be a military hero and a very brave man fighting for his country, he and his friends start to hiss. They cannot bear the idea of a politician daring to presume to touch and raise the flag and believe that they could somehow use their cheap politician's rhetoric to express something as profound and as complicated and as private as one's feelings about one's country. And it's a great example of how Kipling is so much more subtle and so much more surprising than people imagine him to be. But it's also true, I think. 1 minute left, did you say? Thank you very much. I have been going on and on and on. So I don't know if I will end on a quick story for a minute. I've written some down that I think may be appropriate for you. There we go. I'll finish with one because it reminds me of this time of the year. I've just got back from Australia previous time before, there was the steward knelt in front of me and said, "What would you like from the bar?" And I said, "I'll have a vodka and soda water, please." And he said, "One skinny bitch coming right up." And he prepared it and came back. I said, "Did you call it a skinny bitch?" He said, "Well, that's what they call it on the catwalk, darling." He said, "Because it's your maximum alcoholic bang for your minimum calorific buck." Since that was the reason I was drinking it, in the vain hope that it would be less fattening than other drinks, I could see his point. Anyway, I got back, and it was this time of year, and Nigella Lawson was having a birthday party. And at the bar of the place where we met first before we went in to eat, I thought I'd try out my newfound knowledge, and I said to the barman, "Can you fix me a skinny bitch?" And he said, "Sure." And he made one. He knew exactly what it was. And Nigella was fascinated. She said, "Oh, that's really interesting." And I told her the story of the Qantas steward. Then 3 weeks later, I bumped into Nigella, and she said, "Oh, my God, I made such a fool of myself." I said, "Why?" She said, "I went into a bar and asked for a skinny slut." Anyway, thank you very much.